Good afternoon. We're about to get the inaugural lecture, Professor Collins. He's only been here 4.5 years, and so he's rather rushing it by some LSE standards. But we have to put it off for a short while, because Professor Harlow is going to tell us a bit about the program the Law Department have got going for the centennial year. Professor Harlow.
In standing up here, I feel uncomfortably like that person who steps through the curtain before a performance at the English National Opera. There's first of all a murmur of disappointment as the audience imagines that the principal is unwell, which fortunately, as you can see, is not my case tonight. But then probably you turn to thinking that I'm about to fulfil the second function of that personage, and I'm going to ask you for money. But such is not, I assure you, the case, at least not yet. So, in fact, my task is rather a more pleasant one, because we are tonight inaugurating two events, and not merely one. The first is, of course, Hugh's tenure as the Chair of English Law, which is the province of Sir Robin Jacob, and the second is the Law Department's centenary lectures, about which I've been asked to speak. From the time when the decision was taken to make the centennial programme a departmental responsibility, the Law Department was sure that it wanted to make an appropriate contribution to this occasion. The original idea for these lectures actually came from my colleague Richard Rawlings, who reminded us that in 1959, the school published a book composed of 17 public lectures delivered during the session of 1957-8. The theme was borrowed from Dicey's celebrated book on Law and Opinion, and the lectures were subsequently published under the title of Law and Opinion in England in the 20th Century. Maurice Ginsberg, the editor, described the aim as being to discuss controversial areas of public policy and law which raised, and I quote, fundamental issues about which there are profound differences of opinion. Nothing, I believe, could more clearly epitomise the spirit of the LSE. The department liked the idea of a lecture series coherent enough to be publishable and gave the organisers a relatively free hand, though they contributed both the brain and the brawn to the organisation. And here I should like to pause and thank Elizabeth Durant, who has coordinated and acted as secretary to the programme. Two ideas, we felt, infuse our series. The first is the Law Department's special ethos and tradition. And all of you who are alumni or who've worked in the department in any way will know what I mean by this phrase. We like to think that the LSE Law Department mirrors the tradition of the LSE itself in having helped to establish an alternative tradition. Alternative to what? To the two classical Austinian or black letter practitioner traditions which one associates with the common law mind. More positively, to put this more positively, the LSE has pioneered the study of law in context, more correctly in two contexts, the first being the place of law in society, and the second, the study of law in the context of the social sciences. And both ideas are reflected in the title chosen by the Law Department for its centenary lectures, which is Law and Society. In executing this idea, we've turned to the history of the department, celebrating our strengths and the contribution made by the LSE to law reform, and to the study of law during the past 100 years. Of course, not all our strengths could be reflected in a short series. We were, for example, very early in the field of European community law, and we have a long and highly distinguished tradition of family law, to which Olive Stone in particular may be seen as having made a major contribution, and neither of these, we are conscious, is fully represented, and there are other gaps. Nonetheless, we feel that our slate of lectures does reflect many of the LSE's interests and much of its ethos. and we hope very much that you will enjoy it, and that the programme, some copies of which are available at the reception if you haven't already got one, will receive your sustained support and not merely this evening. In a centenary programme, it might be a temptation to dwell too much on the past, as I've suggested we have drawn our inspiration from the past, but this would go against the grain both of our lectures, many of which are prospective in character, and more particularly of the workshop on legal services and dispute resolution, which is part of our contribution to the school's Alumnus Week. Retrospectivity would also belie the main aim, or, if you prefer this terminology, the mission statement of the Law Department, because the Law Department is certainly not solely interested in a glorious past. It looks forward to having a glorious future. As a past convener, I know how much hard work that takes on the part of the staff, and I don't mean just the academic staff, on the part of students, and by no means least, on the part of alumni who have given us unstinting support. And you will share my pleasure that all of those groups are represented in the lecture series. We're celebrating in our centenary an act of faith by a small group of outstanding and committed people. The publication of Law and Opinion fell at a time of repairing the damage of two devastating world wars. We're now moving towards the millennium. I call on all of us to ensure that our future is not a lottery.
Before I say anything about Hugh Collins, I would just add my own word about the centenary. This place is in a unique position, physically. From that, all else follows. You have got here the capacity to be a shining light in the legal world, not because you're good at reading cases, though you're good at that, not because you're good at commenting on acts, that you're good at that, but because you're able to see what's really going on. And the LSE's great contribution must be to keep its eye and its voice on what is really happening and not what people vaguely think are happening by looking at law reports and articles in the Cambridge Law Journal and the like. Now, Professor Collins. His title, The Sanctimony of Contract, that's the sort of word which well, I think I know what it means, but I'm not quite sure. So I went and looked it up. And having looked it up, I'm still not quite sure. It has two meanings. It means, firstly, sanctity. And secondly, it means hypocritical sanctity. We're going to hear shortly which view of contract Professor Collins has. My betting is on the hypocritical side. Shall we see? Professor Collins.
I think that our centenary year should be a time for renewal and restatement of our objectives as lawyers at the LSE. And in considering those objectives, I cannot refrain, I'm afraid, from reflecting on how the four previous holders of this chair in English law defined their respective contributions, for they were important pioneers in our distinctive endeavours in legal education and scholarship. The chair was created in 1924 at the instigation of Sir William Beveridge, the director of the LSE, and Lord Atkin, a governor at the time, and probably the most distinguished judge of the century. Why lawyers should have a place in the School of Social Sciences was by no means obvious, I think. Beveridge felt the need to justify it, and he said that law is an integral part of that study of mankind in society, which is the true scope of the London School of Economics. This claim slid over the difficulty presented by what my colleague Tim Murphy calls the different epistemic basis of law. That is that legal knowledge is not a system for organizing statistical information about society, like sociology and economics. It's rather a system for organizing accumulated wisdom about how to govern society. Yet such a branch of knowledge was, of course, central to the latent agenda of the LSE, the training of students for government and scientific management of human affairs. We should not, though, I think, read too much into this concordance of aims between the study of law and the founders of the LSE. Then, as now, I regret to say, the institution was driven less by ideals than by external market forces, by consumer demand. The chair was urgently required for the purpose of teaching the predecessors of many of you up in the gallery, that is, the first intake of full-time undergraduates to read law. Lord Atkin found the perfect man for the job, Edward Jenks, perhaps the last scholar who knew the whole of English law, who condensed his prodigious learning into a book entitled The Book of English Law. From these small beginnings for law at the LSE, the successor to the chair, Sir David Hughes Parry, I leave out all his qualifications, built extensive foundations for the systematic study of law throughout the university, culminating in the creation of the Institute of Advanced Legal Studies. His continuing brooding omnipresence in the form of lifelike busts in our library and the Institute are tangible testaments, I feel, both to his power as Vice-Chancellor and his special expertise in the law relating to the disposition of property after death. The two subsequent holders of this chair, Ash Wheatcroft and Bill Cornish, who I see here, made two of the most significant contributions to what became the hallmark of legal scholarship at the London School of Economics, the mapping and analysis of new areas of law, in these instances, taxation and intellectual property, respectively. To be sure, lawyers had previously been aware of these subjects, and of course they were discussed pithily and very acutely, I think, in the Book of English Law, but never before had these fields of study been systematically organized according to an economical set of basic principles which permitted the student to see the main legal issues in sharp relief. These were merely two of a long list of legal subjects, such as administrative law, company law, and labor law, which first received systematic analysis in the United Kingdom at the LSE. It requires no false humility on my part, I think, to doubt whether I am capable of emulating these pioneering scholars. I'm not sure even that I wish to try. Certainly, no one could rationally aspire to match the 29 years Hughes Parry spent as departmental convener. My own project of charting a new field of legal study, to be called ice cream law, has been put on ice whilst I conduct the necessary empirical research in the ice cream parlours of the world. I can assure you, however, that the subject is chock-a-block with key legal principles. For instance, it's often overlooked that Lord Atkin's most famous decision, the one case every law student knows, though I fear, like the rest, has not read, Donoghue and Stevenson, concerned the adulteration of a bowl of ice cream with a bottle of ginger beer, which itself was allegedly adulterated. The analogy which I've drawn between maps and the systematization of legal doctrine obscures some important dimensions of the process of mapping the law. A map reconstitutes the common law. Once it was a series of narratives based upon precedents, custom, and memory, from which instruction and proof of validity might be drawn by analogy, like folk tales and myths, into a territory distinct from social practice. The mapping made this territory distinct from social practice with marked boundaries and limited contiguity between aspects of the law. Like all forms of cartography, mapping the law necessarily involves distortions of perspective and conventions of notation. Unlike the natural sciences, which map the animal world into species by detecting family resemblances based upon appearances, such as the conclusion that a spider was a crab rather than an insect due to its number of legs, the lawyers selected elementary moral ideas as their perspective and used the notation of rules to mark out the feature of the terrain. Unlike other maps, which may be falsified by experience, such as discovering an uncharted motorway in one's backyard, legal maps were used to falsify experience. Old precedents, customs, conventional understandings were false if they couldn't be located on the map. The map itself became a source of legal rights and obligations, and knowledge of these maps became the principal ingredient of legal education. At the time when the first maps of English law were inscribed, the study of mankind and society through the social sciences was in its infancy. The early scholars drew their perspectives not from a detailed understanding of the social practices which the law sought to channel and to regulate, but rather from elementary moral principles, which were typically regarded as self-evident or natural. The map of the law of contract, drawn up in the 19th century, for instance, relied for its perspective upon the morality of promise-keeping and appeals to the natural freedom to enter agreements of one's choice. These moral ideas were understood as more than conventional morality, for they amounted to a natural order of social practice, a distillation of customary wisdom confirmed in the tales and myths which form the educational narratives of our society. The equation of contractual and moral obligations through the principle that promises ought to be kept provided the basis for early attempts to generalize and rationalize a single law of contracts. As one judge observed with this new map in front of him, he said, "The true rule for the enforceability of contracts is that whenever a defendant is under a moral obligation or is liable in conscience and equity to pay, that is a sufficient consideration. A breach of contract, therefore, not only broke the legal code, but also threatened to subvert a deeper moral order of promise-keeping, which itself was sustained by narratives such as the Pied Piper of Hamelin, where it may be recalled, the mayor promised to pay the piper 50,000 guilders if he could rid the town of rats, but then once the rats had been drowned in the River Weser, the mayor refused to pay such a large sum. This breach of obligation so rocks the social order that the piper seems entitled to take the children of the town as punishment." As the maps of the law of contract developed, they became increasingly influenced by the second moral perspective, one which insisted upon the natural freedom of the individual. Freedom of contract, that is, the freedom to enter into binding commitments of one's choice and to reject unwelcome obligations, came to be regarded in the 19th century as the cornerstone of liberty and an essential ingredient of social order. Again, this freedom is sanctified by stories such as the tale of Rapunzel, where a man sells his firstborn child to a witch in return for some tasty lettuce called Rapunzel. The tasty lettuce was for his wife, a woman I know who shared with my own wife an ascetic culinary taste exclusively devoted to the consumption of salad. And when the child is born, the man is compelled to hand her over to the witch without exception. Freedom of contract then means the power to select transactions without restraint. It goes to the heart of the modern idea of individual autonomy, the power to shape and plan one's life through cooperation with others by means of binding commitments. When describing these maps of the law of contract, Sir David Hughes Parry, my predecessor, in his Hamelin lectures, entitled The Sanctity of Contract, from which I borrow my title, observes that He observes that with the special emphasis placed by the 19th century philosophers and jurists on the importance of freedom and the manifestation and extension of an individual's freedom through contract, it was not surprising that contracts developed a juristic blessedness or halo and were so often regarded as sacred. This sanctity attributed to contracts is so infectious that it even colours the language of that social science which prides itself most on the amoral rationalist premises that it holds, the science of economics. Economists become so carried away by the rhetoric of the binding obligations of contract that rational choice to break a contract for economic gain is customarily described as opportunism, and the risk of undetected defective performance named as moral hazard. Although the map of the law of contract drew its perspective from these elementary moral ideas, it was simultaneously presented as a practical system of regulation for the ordering of markets. It claimed an understanding of how this natural order of market exchanges worked and insisted that it was responsive to its functional needs. In the rhetoric employed to justify the application of the map to the world of commerce, the crucial gateway, which apparently signals the presence of communication between the practical world of business and the closed doctrinal system of law, was the constant appeal to the virtue of certainty. At first sight, the virtue of certainty in the law of contract appears as a sympathetic response to the practical demands of commerce. It seems to be saying that the court should stick to clear rules so that businesses may plan their transactions with confidence. But on closer inspection, we can see that paradoxically, the virtue of certainty always keeps the gate shut tight against the practical considerations of business. It requires the courts to enforce contracts strictly, without meddling with their terms or altering the rules of law. Certainty requires deftness to the practical considerations in making transactions. Certainty requires an intransigent defence of the integrity of the original map of contract law. Certainty is but a mantra, a euphemism for the sanctity of contracts. The purpose of Sir David Hughes Parry's lectures on the sanctity of contracts was not, however, to defend this fierce moralism of the law, but rather to point out how freedom of contract was heavily circumscribed as a result of legislation and developments in the common law, so that the old maps, which relied upon the natural order of freedom of contract and promise-keeping, could hardly provide a reliable guide for modern students of the subject. Yet Hughes Parry offered no alternative map. Seems to me that the time is ripe for a renewal of efforts to map the law, but now we can draw upon our increased knowledge of how society and the economy functions in order to create a perspective for the map which better depicts the topography of society in which the law operates. Our agenda for the Department of Law in the LSE in the next century should be, I think, to discover how we may employ the new powerful tools of the social sciences, be they statistical regressions, transactions cost economics, game theory, systems theory, cultural and textual deconstruction, and all the other techniques for understanding the causes of things with which this lecture itself is peppered, in order to create maps which better integrate legal studies into Beveridge's wider project of the study of mankind in society. The process of drawing up a new map of the law of contract might commence in this way, with some more careful reflection upon the contribution which the law makes to the creation of binding market commitments. Behind the traditional map, oriented towards the sanctity of contracts, stood the Hobbesian presupposition that the indispensable function of the law of contract is to provide the necessary insurance against breach of promise, for without legal sanction, each party might seek to cheat and renege on the transaction. But does the law of contract really provide credible threats against breach of contract? This seems to me unlikely. For most people aggrieved by breach of contract, the costs of litigation are likely to deter any legal claim. Even if the suit is brought and proves successful, then unless the claim is for a simple money debt, the remedy of compensatory damages will normally fall far short of any deterrent against breach. A buyer of goods can only claim the difference between the contract price and the prevailing market price, which, if the market is competitive, should be minimal. The seller of goods can only claim the loss of the bargain if the goods cannot be sold to another at a similar price. Attempts to increase the level of the threat through penalty clauses will be defeated by the courts invalidating such terms. For most contracts, therefore, the legal sanction provides no credible threat. What then sustains the practice of making contracts? How can this cooperative game be played without legal sanction? For there can be little doubt that contracts would continue to flourish in the absence of legal enforcement. Stuart Macaulay recounts how there was a time when the courts in the United States refused to enforce a contract in which the seller agreed to supply all of the buyer's requirements of a particular good. But the commercial community continued to make such contracts regardless, no doubt because this form of commitment was commercially useful and adequately sustained by non-legal means. The practice of entering contracts relies not so much on the law, I think, but on a mixture of credible threats based upon self-help and credible commitments. Self-help consists of a refusal to perform first or at all if there's a suspicion of opportunism. The practical approach of business is to insist upon cash on delivery, payment in advance, or for employees, no work, no pay. Studies of business contractors reveal that the most important implicit threat consists of a refusal to trade in the future with a particular person or business. As consumers, this is also our only realistic threat, which is a threat that shops which depend upon volume sales and repeat contracting, such as supermarkets and chain stores, take seriously enough to lead them to adopt policies of accepting returns of goods with no questions asked. On the other side of the coin, the credible commitments, these require parties to expose themselves to the risks of losses resulting directly from breach of contract, which do not require the injured party to initiate. Transaction-specific investments are a good example. A contractor who must invest in new machinery in order to complete an order is unlikely to fail to fulfill the order because of the costs of wasting that investment. Investments in reputation will also help to make credible commitments. If, for example, a manufacturer advertises a particular brand name for a product heavily, then consumers will realize that all that investment will be wasted by publicity of just a few cases of poor quality, so that the chances are that the goods will be of high quality. Similarly, the presence of betting shops in every high street, despite the absence of legal enforcement for such transactions, is surely contingent on the reputation of paying out winnings, which could be lost by only a few instances of default. For a consumer, the principal investment will be in the establishment of a good credit rating. In short, the commitment is established and sustained not by the contract, but by perceptible and vulnerable investments. The law does play a supplementary role in establishing credible commitments. It provides techniques for taking hostages against defective performance, and then, in the event of breach, the hostage can be executed. The hostages are called security, that is, property rights such as a mortgage, a reservation of title clause, or a deposit, property rights which can be asserted unilaterally without the cooperation of the party in breach of contract. The law can also support the use of alternative dispute resolution mechanisms, such as arbitration, which lower the cost of litigation and therefore can increase the threat of the sanction for breach of contract. The most important alternative dispute resolution technique is simply one of discipline provided by the rules of the contract, such as dismissal for employees and acceleration clauses for debtors. I'm not arguing that the law of contracts serves no useful purposes at all. On the contrary, it achieves two essential purposes in a market economy. In the first place, it permits ex ante price setting. In other words, it permits people to set the price for exchanges in advance, which is vital to assure Pareto superior outcomes. The alternative of allowing prices to be set after the exchange, as the Pied Piper did in setting the price for his services as the value of all the children in the town, could be disastrous for the market as an institution for enhancing wealth. Secondly, the law of contract provides one of several mechanisms for transfers of title to property. The purpose which the law of contract claims for itself, however, namely to secure the enforceability of promises and agreements, is not a purpose, I think, which it can legitimately claim. The link between the law of contract and the morality of promise-keeping, that appeal to foundation and origin in the antique pacta sunt servanda, must therefore be exposed as illusory as the emperor's new clothes. Traditional maps of the law of contract assumed these robes for the sanctity of contract and recited the law as a series of incantations derived from its supposed moral principles. But this was always a pretense, for the law could do little to compel people to make reliable commitments. On what little it might do by offering coercive sanctions, it invariably declined. Our new map, if it is to serve as a useful travel guide, must focus instead on the legal contribution to the construction of credible threats and commitments. The principal function of the law of contract is, in short, to serve as a device for making arrangements in which there is no need to rely upon the contract. Beyond this rough guide to the role of the law of contract, the map of the law needs to explain the location and reasons for all those restrictions on freedom of contract which so puzzled Sir David Hughes Parry. Freedom of contract, unlike other freedoms, is not a protection from the power of others, including organisations like the state, but a privilege for individuals to construct and regulate social relations, thereby creating a power relation. What limits should be placed on the freedom to construct social relations in the form of a contract? These limits may either comprise restrictions on the subject matter of contracts, such as prohibiting the sale of babies like Rapunzel, or controls over the use of bargaining resources, such as prohibiting the use of magic pipes or enchantments to secure favourable terms. In recent years, a resurgence in the belief of markets, the belief in markets, and thus contractual relations, has characterized political life. In place of institutional direction and democratic organization, markets have been created by the instrument of contracts. The internal market of the National Health Service, for example, replaces centralized administration with devolved contracting powers to doctors and hospitals. Similarly, the Citizens' Charter envisages the establishment of contractual rights for consumers with respect to the allocation of public goods and state services. Perhaps in the not-too-distant future, we will learn that a first-class student is not one who excels in examinations, but rather like a passenger on an airplane, is the customer who, having paid a premium fee, is entitled to extra tuition and facilities. This resurgence of faith in markets springs, I believe, from a number of sources. It rests on an explicit assumption that markets are the most efficient method for the satisfaction of consumer wants. This assumption is, of course, only partially true, for the market doesn't recognize preferences in the absence of a willingness and ability to pay. But the resurgence of markets rests also, I think, on two further assumptions which are seldom articulated. The seductive claim of markets as a principle for distributing wealth and power, one much vaunted by Hayek, for example, is that they avoid any governmental choice with respect to the pattern of distribution. The stock of goods and the power over others which each citizen possesses depends upon the myriad of market transactions rather than any determining human agency. The invisible hand of market forces appears to require no justification. Governments can eschew responsibility for the outcomes of markets. People who are unemployed have only themselves to blame, since they've priced themselves out of jobs. This stance raises interesting moral questions about whether a government may be held responsible for foreseeable, though unspecific, outcomes in relation to individuals. We can see that those possessing fitness, talent, and capital will prosper, and others who lack these resources will not. But does this degree of foresight bring with it a responsibility upon governments to alter the effects? A question which I won't answer. Perhaps the most deepest attraction of markets, though, I think today, in our perhaps postmodern world, is the way that markets avoid the presence of institutionalized structures giving direction to people about how to lead their lives. A market driven by consumer preferences binds a society together into a social order without explicit direction from institutionalized centers of power, like government. The preference for markets over organization reveals a skepticism with respect to any claim to know best how social relations should be organized, and perhaps a fear that such institutionalized power will be abused and manipulated in order to destroy individuality. Politics can avoid these difficulties by abandoning institutionalized structures of power and replacing them with markets, which merely respond to transient preferences of people. The ultimate criterion of government and law becomes the satisfaction of consumer preferences. Politics becomes like manufacturing industry, a quest to establish the largest market share by satisfying the widest range of consumer preferences. As Magnet Desai, a colleague here at the LSC in economics, observed in his own inaugural lecture a few years ago, what these various developments have in common is a deep suspicion of human agency, especially of popularly elected government. In our own small world of the law school, we feel these pressures in contests over the law curriculum. Should the students take the courses which they want, or should the faculty determine what branches of legal knowledge best equip a student to understand the principles of the law and the context in which it operates? Faith in the market as a natural force is so powerful that attempts to divert it or shape it are thought to be both futile and harmful. Thus, professorial control over the syllabus will be rejected as not only an illegitimate bid for power over consumer preferences, but also a pointless gesture, since it would spoil the attraction of the degree to customers and so destroy the program which Jenks initiated. This image of the world of freedom of contract, a natural order untainted by illegitimate authority structures, which serves the goal of increasing welfare, must, I feel, be challenged. We should recognize that contractual relations construct a certain kind of social relation, one which can be useful and productive, but which attributes a particular kind of meaning to social relations. And I want to draw out that meaning, if I can, in four dimensions. Contracts, first of all, create a particular form of valuation of conduct. They purport to measure conduct narrowly by reference solely to the terms recorded for the transaction. As Peter Goodrich has observed from a grammatological point of view, I think, the contract may here be interpreted in the sense of contrajo. It draws together, it binds. But we may note that in doing so, it also implies a contraction. It abridges, shortens, encodes, and represses. The parties to the contract have their conduct defined by the binary opposite of performance or breach. The terms purport to set the exclusive point of reference. We then encounter the interesting phenomenon that strict insistence upon terms in the contract is itself regarded as a form of opportunism and damaging to the reputation necessary for credible commitments by businesses bound together by frequent transactions. In a study of contracts between businesses in a particular locality, Beale and Dugdale observed, for instance, that any attempt to shelter behind contractual provision or even frequent citation of contractual terms would destroy the firm's reputation very quickly. Businesses expect a degree of cooperation, some give and take, not exclusive reliance on the terms of the contract, and their business reputation for fair dealing depends on reciprocity of this kind. Secondly, contracts also establish social relations which have a currency of exchange which is quantifiable, measurable, and limited. It renders transparent and accountable the reciprocal obligations between persons. Diffuse obligations of support, cooperation, reciprocity, and sharing become excluded. This contrast becomes most marked in agency relations such as employment, where the more that the employer seeks to control the employee's discretion about how to define and carry out tasks, the less the employer can call upon diffuse obligations of loyalty to further the employer's business. Contracts occupy the domain of what Max Weber called formal rational economic action, which he regarded as the hallmark of modernity, rendering modern society a contractual society. Although Weber believed there to be a natural or practical limits to formal rational economic action, the new technologies of accounting and auditing seem to me to render all forms of action susceptible to calculation and measurement. Quality assurance techniques, for example, of sampling and assessment against a calibrated scale, can be applied to all fields of human endeavour. A sample of 4 items over a given period, calibrated on a scale of 7 points, is the current measure of scholarship in the universities, and I discovered recently is also applied to imported Russian condoms. A third feature of contracts consists in their compulsion to atomize social relations so that the effects of a transaction upon other people are treated as externalities, that is, effects which are an irrelevant consideration within this system of government. The recent controversy over the high pay of senior executives in privatized industries illustrates this dynamic of contractual relations. The rate of pay is set and defended by reference to the market rate for executives and the responsibilities of the job. The pay of other members of the organisation, indeed their very jobs, is treated as irrelevant to this relation, even though they are all members of the same organisation. Similarly, in the recent decision to permit employers to offer higher wages to workers who belong to one union as opposed to another, the contractual conception of the relation between employer and employer renders the effects on union membership of other employees another irrelevant consideration. A fourth and final feature of contracts which should be emphasized concerns the type of power relation which they create. Although the imagery of freedom of contract presents a democratic picture of two people negotiating the terms of their agreement, in practice, most contracts constitute the opportunity for one party to create unilaterally a system of rules and governance structures for the relation. The standard form contract, familiar to consumers when entering purchases of expensive durables from its printed form, though presumably they're not familiar with its content, represents a truncated version of this power relation. It blossoms fully when the contract incorporates whole codes of regulations and procedures, such as staff handbooks, works rules, railway bylaws, and quality assurance procedures. These regulatory systems simulate a contractual form and draw their authority from the contract, but they really represent the exercise of discretionary power by one party to the contract over the other, backed up by a system of economic sanctions specific to that relation, such as discipline of the employee or disqualification of the contractor. The illusion of sanctity of contract confers the power to discipline and punish. These 4 features of contractual relations as a form of social relation: the valuation in artificially delimited terms, the measurement by a precise currency of exchange, the externalization of social effects, and the unilateral rulemaking power. These features surely raise questions about the contemporary faith in markets. How far can we permit the reduction of social relations to this form? Consider, for instance, an aspect of the law of death which Hughes Parry omitted from his comprehensive work on the law of succession, the idea of a living will. Suppose that I'm informed that I suffer from a terminal illness, though some months remain for my life. I then seek to make a bargain with my doctors, specifying which treatments will be used and the point at which my life will be terminated, such as perhaps the moment when I am unable to savour ice cream. The contract satisfies my preferences as a patient and it states a measurable criterion for performance. Who could object to this arrangement? It concerns no one else. To regard this as a valid transaction, however, necessarily requires elimination of the standards of homicide set by the criminal law and the standards of professional conduct established by the medical profession. Moreover, the contract treats everyone else's preferences, such as my family, other hospital workers, as irrelevant. But on the other hand, to insist that the living will should not be effective, to insist that this issue should not be within the scope of delegated powers to individuals, requires an affirmation of faith in public standards, of the right of organisations, such as the medical profession, to set standards of conduct. It requires a deafness to the claims of others, such as family, to influence one's choices, all of which runs against this feature that I've seen in modern life of the contractualization of social life. Modern corporations are the location of some of the most important debates about the scope of contractual relations. One way of perceiving a modern business organisation is through a network of contracts between shareholders, lenders, directors, employees, contractors and creditors, radiating out through contractual relations from the central core of the corporate entity itself. To perceive the business organisation in this way permits each group to pursue its own interests without any concern for the other parties who are bound to the organisation. Once the Articles of Association become regarded simply as another contract, this time between shareholders, then this contractual framework destroys any sense that the corporate entity comprises an organisation which has to balance the interests of various constituencies. These four dimensions of contractual relations raise perplexing moral issues, but not, I think, those highlighted by the traditional focus on freedom of contract. The key issue, to my mind, comprises the extent to which we should permit social relations to be constructed according to these values. Contracts involve a delegation of power to create a type of social relation which envisages a limited scope for valuation of conduct, requires precise measurement of action, eschews concern for the impact on others, and frequently grants a discretionary power to one party to regulate the conduct of the other. Far from avoiding questions of justice and morality in government, the institution of contract poses a severe threat, I think, to any society which seeks to establish any bonds of solidarity and to avoid undemocratic power relations. How does the law of contract respond to this moral issue? Sir David Hughes Parry observed that freedom of contract had been was unable to map a coherent scheme of these restrictions. The reason, I suggest, stems from that ideal of sanctity of contract which he sought to expose. That halo topping freedom of contract reduced the available legal discourses to account for that branch of law to a set of principles which could all be grounded in the ideal of freedom itself. Choices to enter contractual relations could only be restricted in order to protect choices. Rules governing fraud, duress, undue influence could all be justified as techniques designed to protect freedom of contract, to ensure that genuine choices were made. These rules could be extended by using the economic concept of market failure. Any choices made under conditions of imperfect information or restrictions on competition could also be invalidated. This paradoxical basis for contract law, in which restrictions on freedom of choice had to be justified as protections of freedom of choice, created, I think, an unstable doctrinal map, though one which could be usefully exploited for instrumental concerns by masters of this doublethink like Lord Denning. But more significantly, the sanctity of contract stifled what Roberto Unger calls the institutional imagination of contract lawyers, that is, their ability to provide a map which resisted the magnetic single polarity of freedom of contract. This perspective could not encompass the moral issues posed by the contractualization of social life. On the contrary, the sanctity of contract could only give fresh impetus to transactions such as the living will, and to lead to recommendations to confirm Rapunzel's fate by enforcing contracts for the sale of babies. The sanctity of contract insists upon the possibility of universal commodification, in which every item which is scarce and valued may be bought and sold for money. The halo encircling freedom of contract thus encourages the reduction of agreements and exchanges to the limited form of monetary transactions. The sanctity is attached to money, in short, sanctimony. One way, therefore, to analyse the restrictions on the freedom of contract observed by Hughes Parry is to understand how these restrictions seek to counteract the meaning which contractualization brings to social relations, how, in effect, the law seeks to ascribe a different meaning to these relations. So the way I'm seeing these restrictions on freedom of contract is all efforts to change the meaning of these social relations in ways that otherwise the contract law would play havoc with. Compulsory terms, for example, represent an important practical tool which serves this purpose. A consumer, for instance, is always entitled to goods and services of satisfactory quality, as I told the first years this morning, no longer merchantable quality, satisfactory quality in view of the price paid. Traders are not permitted to use their superior bargaining resources to alter reasonable expectations of the price-quality ratio. An employee has an entitlement to be protected from unreasonable disciplinary action, regardless of the content of the staff handbook. Shareholders enjoy certain rights to influence the conduct of the company, regardless of the way in which the Articles of Association allocate powers. With the new intelligibility requirement from European law for terms of consumer contracts, the standard form contract, like the product, must be made user-friendly. These examples represent efforts to establish a particular kind of meaning for the contractual relations, one which is concerned with externalities, with transparency and pooling bargaining resources, and with the distribution and exercise of power in private organisations established by contracts. Yet the technique of compulsory terms suffers from the weakness that it continues to rely upon the contract as the exclusive measure of the obligations undertaken. A bolder departure from the traditional conception of contract regards the terms of the transaction as evidence of its content and purpose, but the full extent of the obligations will be fixed by reference to broader social standards, such as fairness, carefulness, cooperation, and good faith. Under the influence of European law, I suspect that these generalized sources of obligations, which cannot be referenced to the intentions of the parties as stated in the terms of the contract, will become an increasingly important source of obligations inserted into contractual relations in order to channel their meaning in particular directions. English lawyers fear this challenge to the settled common law practice of using the terms as the exclusive point of reference. But I believe that these generalized sources of obligations will merely bring the law much closer in its estimations of performance or breach to the perceptions of the parties themselves, the parties to contracts, of when they think that the obligation has been broken. Consider, for instance, the events in the early 1950s, round about my birth, which resulted in the celebrated decision in Davis Contractors and Fareham Urban District Council. A contractor agreed with the council to build 78 houses for a fixed price of £92,000. 78 houses for £92,000, makes you think. But due to a lack of skilled labour and shortages of bricks, the job took much longer than expected and cost the contractor about £17,000 more than the contract price. The House of Lords, the Judicial Committee of the House of Lords, applied the simple rule of strict liability and insisted that the contractor was bound by the contract price, so could make no claim for the additional £17,000. This decision, however, overruled the original arbitrator, who had permitted the price increase on the ground that the parties had entered the contract on the basis that an adequate supply of labour and material would be available. I suspect that the arbitrator was more in touch with the customs of the building trade and was prepared to allow the implicit and informal understandings evidenced in the negotiations between the parties and surrounding the contract to influence his decision, rather than to confine the source of legal obligations to the written contract itself, as the House of Lords did. So I think that these new European dimensions, where we insist upon very general sources of contractual obligations based upon ideas like good faith, are in fact much more likely to accord with the party's own perceptions of when the contract has been performed and when it has been broken. My argument then is that the general objective of these rules of contract law, which restrict freedom of contract, is to counter the meaning which unrestricted contractual freedom can give to these relations. But it's unhelpful to regard these rules as restrictions on freedom of contract, for that perspective retains the distortion of the sanctity of contract by assuming that unrestricted delegation of power to choose transactions is the normal or natural state of affairs. On the contrary, the normal or natural state of affairs comprises social relations which draw on a wider pool of norms and standards for constructing obligations. The crucial question, then, is when will the parties to a contract, through an agreement, be permitted to distort and truncate such obligations by means of the device of contracts? From this perspective, the decision in Davis Contractors and Fareham District Council ceases to be a conventional celebration of freedom of contract, but a contentious decision to legitimise arguments which artificially circumscribed the reciprocal obligations. In the new map of the law, the rules of contract law become a list of the valid and invalid techniques for restricting the scope of obligations arising from voluntary undertakings, and questions of validity turn ultimately on the morality of denying the social obligations arising in market transactions. My description of how a new map of the law of contract might be drawn perhaps makes it sound rather more complicated than it is in fact. The process merely addresses two questions. What does the law of contract achieve in fact? And what moral issues does this practice raise? I think that's all I've been talking about. The traditional map, which started with the morality of promises and insisted upon the presumption of freedom of contract, drew a terrain populated by rules about how to create binding agreements. The sanctity accorded to contractual agreements encouraged the law to make false boasts about its power to borrow from and reinforce this morality, and at the same time discouraged any criticism of the contractualization of social relations. The new map, however, should be interested in how to make binding commitments in practice. That is, how the law may usefully strengthen and control the use of private sanctions. And the new map should adopt as its central moral focus the way the law serves to counter the logic of contractualization by reconstructing social relations according to imagined possibilities of a social market. These signposts towards a new cartography of contract law are surely no more complicated than the directions which you are about to receive as to the location of the reception following my lecture. Thank you.
Well now, that's about 1,000,000 miles from Cheshire and Fivefoot. And it's exactly what the LSE is for. Thinking about what the law is, as opposed to just reciting what it is. Professor Collins has given us a whole new way of looking at the law of contract in context. We must all thank him very much, but before we do so, I should tell you that everybody is invited to drinks upstairs, senior commandant, fifth floor.